Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Anthony Todd, and along with my colleague Eric Hughes, we represent Gregory Walker, pursuant to a 7-Eleven license through the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern University School of Law. This Court should reverse and remand for three reasons. First, Mr. Walker suffered a due process violation when he was denied access to potentially exculpatory material.
Denied what?
Denied access to potentially exculpatory material, Your Honor.
I don't understand. It's his stuff, right?
It's his stuff.
Being held by a state court?
It's being held by a local police department, Your
Honor. Local police department, right? Why doesn't he go to the local police department and ask for to look at his stuff, right?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, this was a federal prosecution, and he asked for a trial subpoena in federal court.
I don't understand. If the police department is holding on to his personal property with no reason to do so, why doesn't he complain to the police department? Has he gone to the police department and says, I want my stuff back? Or does he insist on getting a subpoena from a federal judge?
Okay. Your Honor, in this case, trial counsel did ask for the subpoena from the federal judge. He did not go directly to the police department. However, it's reasonable to believe...
Well, I don't understand that. I mean, first of all, you ought to know, I don't understand. What exculpatory material does he think the police department is holding on to him?
Your Honor, there are several things that the police department is holding on to that could be exculpatory. In fact, we have a warrant inventory at A42
that
tells us...
Well, why doesn't he go and ask the police department for his stuff back?
Your Honor, once again, he did ask...
Why is the police department holding it?
We do not know, Your Honor.
Well, why don't you find out? Why don't you ask the police department, why are you holding my client's papers or whatever they are?
Your Honor, the only answer I can give you is the trial counsel believed that asking for a subpoena in federal court was the proper way to get this material.
Well, that's ridiculous.
And that's what he did.
That's ridiculous.
Now, second, the district court erred in failing to give a theory of defense instruction. On this issue, we would like to rest on our briefs, unless there are any questions. And third, the district court's restitution calculation was improper. Now, turning first to the Brady issue. Now, the body of evidence that Mr. Walker was denied access to, which included multiple computers...
Oh, come on. You haven't given any reason. He didn't exhaust his remedies, which the first remedy was to ask the police department to give his stuff back.
Your Honor, in Brady cases, a defendant is required...
This is not a Brady case. This is not exculpatory evidence supplied by some third party. It's his own stuff. Doesn't he know what it is? What does he think is exculpatory in that material of his?
Your Honor, he believes that several things are exculpatory.
Well, I'll settle for one thing.
For instance, the records of his construction company. The government argued at trial extensively that the reason for the inflated loan values was to take money. They argued his construction company was a complete fraud. They said it didn't exist. It wasn't
okay,
real.
So now
he says
there's only one set of these records and they're in the police department. He doesn't have any other records.
These are his personal business records. They
swept his entire house
and seized everything.
Is there no copy of them anywhere in a bank or something?
He does not have the ability to reconstruct them. They were not replicated. He did not have the ability to reconstruct them. The police, when they searched his house...
Is there another copy anywhere?
No, not that we know of, Your Honor.
What do you mean, not that you know of? He should know of.
He says there's
not
another...
Well, did he have any dealings with banks?
He did have dealings with banks, Your Honor, and records from that came in at trial.
Well, didn't he have to submit various company records in order to get loans?
Presumably, Your Honor, he did.
Well, then the banks have these. So go to the banks and find them.
We may have been able to reconstruct...
Have you asked the banks?
His trial counsel did not subpoena any of the banks. He may have been able...
To subpoena the banks? You ask the banks first.
He may have been able to reconstruct some of these records. Also, six different computer hard drives containing his business records were seized when the police swept his house. He couldn't reconstruct all the material contained on those hard drives.
And they're in the police department?
They're at the police department, Your Honor.
How can this be a Brady violation when none of the items were in possession of the government or any agency investigating this case?
Your Honor, we would argue that the unique factual circumstances in this case give rise to constructive possession.
I don't think it's unique at all. It's just a matter of trying to gather evidence. And if there's some piece of evidence which a third party has, you go and ask the third party for it. Now, maybe they, if they refuse, then, of course, that would strengthen your argument for asking it for a subpoena. But if you don't even ask them,
Your Honor,
it makes it sound totally phony, the whole business.
Your Honor, to address this concern, one of the problems here is that once the government is on notice that exculpatory material exists, and we believe that trial counsel at pre-trial hearings did make that argument, he connected it to his theory of defense. Once the government is on notice that that material exists, they have a responsibility to review it. And they did nothing in this case. They simply argued that it was irrelevant. They continue to
say, you're saying the government has an opportunity, if the defendant says, well, John Smith has some material that's relevant to me, you go get it. You're saying the government has an obligation to go do the work of the defendant?
No, not in every circumstance. In fact, not in most circumstances. But in this particular circumstance, there were several elements that point to the fact that the government should have reviewed the material. First off, it was in the hands of law enforcement. Second, they opposed his access to it. They didn't simply sit back and fold their hands and say, okay, well, you could go get it. They said this is irrelevant. They said it's frivolous. They mocked his request for the material at evidentiary hearings.
No, that's totally irrelevant. What Judge Gilbert is asking is simply, can you use Brady to make the government do the defendant's investigation for him? To say to the government, look, you know, I think there may be exculpatory evidence somewhere. Would you please go look and do a really thorough search? Because if you don't have a really thorough search, I'm going to wave Brady in the face of the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, I would say that's not the case here. We had a very specific set of materials. We had a warrant inventory, and we knew where the materials were. And at least other circuits have said that the prosecutors...
What if you knew it was in his attic? And he said to the police, it's in my attic, but I don't like to go up to my attic. It's dark there, and there may be some rodents. So would you please go up and get my stuff out of my attic?
Your Honor, I would...
wouldn't fly, would it?
That certainly would not fly,
no,
Your Honor.
I don't see the difference.
The difference here is that...
You ask the police. If they say, no, we're keeping your hard drives, then, of course, you ask for a subpoena.
And in this case, the defense attorney skipped that step and asked for the subpoena. However, they did not ask the government. The first thing they did was not saying, government, go to the attic. Government, go far and wide. They said, we've identified the material. We know where it is. We'd like a trial subpoena to have it turned over. And in fact, at the October evidentiary hearing, the counsel believed
they
would be there waiting
for it. The question is why they skipped the initial stage of asking the custodian for this stuff. But anyway, what did you want to say about restitution?
Your Honor, turning to the restitution issue, at sentencing, the government did not support its restitution calculation. Instead, it urged the district court to accept, unsubstantiated, the calculations contained in the pre-sentence report. Now, it's important to look at this issue against a backdrop that this court has repeatedly acknowledged, but the government does not, which is that this is not a sentencing guidelines challenge. This is an MVRA challenge, and they're different for important reasons that are dispositive here. Judges are allowed wide latitude in sentencing, but this latitude is curtailed in the restitution context. In order to impose a restitution order under the MVRA, a judge must identify a clear victim as well as substantiate the amount of damage done to that victim. And neither was done in this case.
Didn't the district court adopt the pre-sentence investigation report?
Not explicitly, Your Honor, but it could be inferred. However, the pre-sentence report contained no evidence about exactly where the supposed losses came from. All that was
there was actually a chart.
The
government's position was more than what the district court ordered in restitution, did it not?
The government's position included one property that the defense successfully got excluded.
South Highland property, right?
South Highland property, yes.
And the district judge took that out?
The district judge did take that out.
To the benefit of the defendant?
To the benefit of the defendant, Your Honor. But they still did not substantiate. The district court judge still did not substantiate exactly who was the loser, for instance. There's no victim that's clear in this case.
There is a list of victims So we have the property address, total loan amount, loss amount, victim. Now, what is it? What does he want to add there?
Now, the problem here, Your Honor, is that Mr. Walker has been ordered to pay almost $1 million in restitution to Long Beach Mortgage, which was the company that issued the buy-side loans, the loans he took out to buy the properties. those loans were paid back, and the government admitted in its brief that it only based its restitution amounts on the sell-side loans, on different loans completely, and, moreover, they never showed who owned those sell-side loans.
I understand. So the first item, 9023 South Kingston, says total loss amount, total loan amount, $204,000, loss amount, $95,000. Now, what are those two figures?
So the loan amount is the sales side loan of a later buyer who got a loan to buy the property, and then the second number is the foreclosure number. And actually, I'm glad you pointed to that Kingston amount because it exemplifies why this was a shoddily done calculation, because you'll notice that in that first column there's actually an arithmetic error as well. They don't do the subtraction correctly. And so in addition to not presenting victim affidavits, bank statements,
What is this arithmetical error?
The idea that the one was subtracted from the other, if you look at all the columns, the second number was subtracted from the first to result in the final, that first column doesn't even have that, Your Honor.
What are you talking about? It says total loan amount, $204,000, loss amount, $95,000. So slowly explain why you think that those are not meaningful figures.
Your Honor, I believe there's an intervening column with a foreclosure amount. At least there is in the version attached to the...
I'm looking at the pre-sentence report.
I'm sorry.
Looking at something else?
In the government's version of the offense, which was attached to the pre-sentence report, there's an additional column that shows the foreclosure amount. That's not actually very much important, Your Honor. All it goes to show is that, once again, these were not substantiated. In many cases like this, there's victim affidavits. They trace the loans to the actual lender that owns the loans. Mr. Walker is not paying restitution to the banks that supposedly lost money as a result of his actions. Now, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, and even though my night's not on,
I understand. It says LBM is listed as a victim. You mean it's not getting any money?
Long Beach Mortgage is getting money as a result of Mr. Walker's payments. But Long Beach Mortgage, there's no evidence in the record that it actually lost any money. In fact, Mr. Walker discharged those loans to Long Beach Mortgage. They were paid. And the government admits in its brief, because we objected to this in our opening brief,
evidence that they had been paid?
We do have evidence, for instance, that he made mortgage payments. We also have evidence that the materials, the property were sold to additional people.
Just because he made mortgage payments doesn't mean that restitution didn't know.
Your Honor, we do have evidence, and in fact, one piece of it is at A66 in our appendix that suggests that another bank held the mortgage on the Hermitage property, at least. We don't have the records on all of them, but there is, for instance, the Bank of New York, which has not ordered restitution at all, even though that was the foreclosing bank. Once again, Your Honor, if I may reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Sure. Thank you. Okay. Ms. Romero?
May it please the Court, my name is Jessica Romero, and I represent the appellee, the United States. There was no Brady violation in this case, as this Court has already identified. Defendants rely on an unrecognized theory of Brady in order to make a claim.
Well, what about the restitution? Can you address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. There were several misrepresentations regarding the record at sentencing.
Well, it would be helpful if you could explain. So I'm looking at the first line in the loss and restitution amounts in the pre-sentence report. So you have loan amount and loss amount. There's not actually a separate statement about it, or a separate restitution amount. So what are those figures? Total loan amount and then $204,000 loan amount, then $95,000 loss amount. What's that?
The court's referring to the chart in the government's version?
No, I'm actually looking at the pre-sentence report.
Okay. The basis for that information, essentially, and my goal is to spend just a couple minutes explaining the context of all this. The nature of the scheme was that the defendant purchased properties in fraudulent transactions and then sold them in fraudulent transactions. The methodology that was used to calculate the actual loss amount, not a general estimate, but the actual loss amount, was to subtract the value of the fraudulently obtained loans at the time that he sold the properties, subtract that value from the value recovered after foreclosure sales. And that was detailed and itemized in the government's version. We set forth the specific...
Well, concretely, and I'm asking about these figures. Mm-hmm.
So the figures were derived using that
method. So what is the $204,000?
The difference between this, the value of...
No, that's... It, look, it's in the column on total loan amount. So what is the $204,000 total loan amount? What does that mean?
That would be the value of the loan that was obtained through the fraud.
And this was a loan point. And this was borrowed from LBM?
Correct. It was Long Beach Mortgage.
So he borrowed $204,000. And are you saying LBM recovered all but $95,000?
Correct, Your Honor. So essentially, is this specifically the Kingston property?
Yes, Kingston.
So the Kingston property, and there was actually evidence of this at trial, the Kingston property was sold by the defendant after purchasing it to his own girlfriend, McChristian. And that was one of the basis for one of the counts in the indictment. The evidence at trial was that the defendant, with the help of Carol Simmons, was able to sell the property to his girlfriend, who fraudulently represented herself to be a qualified borrower. And there were fraudulent representations regarding the value of the property in connection with that transaction. So the basis for the total loan amount values, there was either one or two loans that were issued in order for her to purchase the property as a result of that transaction. Those are either totaled or perhaps it was just one single loan. And then years later, after the property is foreclosed on, if there's a foreclosure sale, we deduct the amount of money recovered at the foreclosure sale.
Now, Mr. Todd said LBM didn't lose anything.
That's incorrect. And the record makes clear that Long Beach Mortgage actually financed, was the lender, both for the transactions in which the defendant was a borrower, but also the transactions in which he was a seller. So in other words, even though as part of the scheme they were paying off one mortgage, it was with a fraudulently obtained subsequent mortgage from the same lender in this case.
How much are you saying is owed to Long Beach Mortgage, LBM?
Well, so at the time of sentencing, the government had adopted a different loss calculation, as the court identified earlier, which included an additional property called the South Hellmann property. The probation officer disagreed with the government's calculation with respect to that single property and excluded it from its actual loss calculation. And at the sentencing hearing, the district court adopted...
Loss and restitution don't have to be identical.
That's correct, but in this case they are. And absolutely, I understand the case law on this, which is general estimates of loss that place a defendant within one general category of an enhancement for the guidelines aren't necessarily the most reliable detail, you know, dollar and cent figure for restitution. But in this case, they're actually the same figure.
Did you receive an victim impact statement from LBM saying this is the amount of money we lost?
No, Your Honor. That we essentially use public records. One of the things that's come up during the course of these proceedings is, and they were referenced kind of generally, this notion that they were public records that established, you know, what payments were made in connection with what mortgage. Our government's version summarized all of those records and indicated the difference between the value of the sale by Long Beach Mortgage or its successor at the time that the foreclosure sale took place.
Well, how come you didn't go to Long Beach Mortgage and say, how much money have you lost?
Well, we did. We subpoenaed the records, but it's thousands of pages of documents. They don't actually summarize the data for us. That's something that we do for purposes of expediting the proceedings. In every respect, it's something that the defense is able to duplicate. It's basic arithmetic, and they had the underlying documents.
I was puzzled what you said about South Hellmann.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's listed as with $169,000 loss amount. And I thought you said that the probation service disagreed with the prosecutor about it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Having listed it as a loss amount, it just changed its mind?
And I apologize, Your Honor, but I believe you might be referring to the government's version. I do recall specifically that we presented that information in our government's version, and the PSR addressed the issue that this had been presented to them, but rejected including that value in the calculation of loss.
That's not in the PSR. There's a column on loss amount, and then on the next page it says You know, court should order the defendant make immediate payment, so on. And there's no suggestion that South Holland is to be treated separately from the other properties.
Your Honor, I believe that's the government's version of the offense. The chart that Your Honor is referring to was in the government's version of the offense. It is not contained in the PSR itself. Well, the government's version is attached to it, but that chart...
Oh, you mean I'm not looking at the pre-sentence report, I'm looking at something else? I don't know, it says...
You're looking at the government's version, which is attached to the pre-sentence report.
Pardon?
There's a pre-sentence report with it. It says they take out the South Highway.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. I'm sorry.
It's okay, Your Honor.
Confused.
The other kind of characterization of the record that I wanted to address was this notion that there was no evidence that was provided to support any type of conclusion that the sale of these properties was somehow conducted as part of the scheme. Again, in the grand context of things, the defense did not object to the relevant conduct determinations by the district court or the calculation of actual loss, which was the specific dollar figure lost by Long Beach Mortgage. And indeed, there were summaries of records that were provided in the PSR, as the court has identified. The defendant's sentencing memorandum actually attached a settlement statement for one of the additional properties. One of the transactions that took place in May 2007. The government's version also attached a memorandum of interview for the caretaker of the purported buyer in that transaction, who indicated he was an incapacitated elderly individual who was incapable of attending or participating in any transaction. And again, the government's version details this information, and a lot of it is also contained in the PSR. With respect to the transactions with Mr. Wade, the government's version set forth a factual basis, and that was never objected to in the district court. This notion that there were payments that were made that should have somehow offset the restitution figure is also incorrect, because those payments were made before the fraudulent loans were issued in the transactions in which he sold the properties. So it's immaterial to the calculation of actual loss and restitution. And I want to make sure I'm perfectly clear on the fact that Long Beach Mortgage records were the basis of those calculations. Finally, just because of the nature of the argument, I do want to clarify some of the arguments that were made with respect to the Brady claim. I know the court understands that they're asking the court to interpret Brady in a way that's just not recognized. But in addition to that, I wanted to make sure I clarify some of the representations regarding what happened in the district court. The most important thing for this court to understand is the different context in which the defendant sought the information in the district court, as opposed to the arguments he now makes on appeal. In the district court, the defendant just generally sought information about who possessed the items for the purposes of filing a motion under Silverthorne to suppress the indictment or dismiss the indictment. So it was for the purpose of alleging that the federal prosecution had been tainted. The defense not once alleged that that evidence was favorable, that it was exculpatory, or that they wanted it to defend the case at trial or at sentencing. It was to the contrary. The relief that they wanted was to enforce the exclusionary rule because the evidence was incriminating and, according to them, had been improperly obtained and somehow used to indict the case in federal court. As the record makes crystal clear, that's absolutely not the case. There was this argument that somehow the government was put on notice that there was favorable and exculpatory evidence in those materials. Again, the record, both in terms of the defendant's own motions at 200 on the record, and the transcripts of all the hearings make clear that the opposite was the case. He believed the evidence in there to be incriminating, and he wanted to suppress it. He didn't want the government to possess it in the first place. And the government never did. There was also the notion that somehow the government had blocked their attempt to obtain the information. They kind of blur the issue between the government's obligations under Brady and the district court's discretion regarding subpoenas. Essentially, there was a very broad subpoena that was issued. and the defendant came to court and clarified all he wanted to know is, had this been in the possession of the federal prosecution team in order to move to dismiss the indictment? Absolutely never did he represent to me or to the district court that the contents of the records were favorable, and in fact that that's what he wanted. And it was in that context that he withdrew a very broad subpoena. And finally, as this court has identified, the district court itself encouraged the defendant to file a motion for return of property in state court, which it could have done. This wasn't a situation where there was any asymmetry in information between what the government knew about the materials or what the defense knew about the materials. And to the extent there was any, it was tipped in favor of the defense because, as the court has identified, there were his materials taken from his home, which he had possessed and moved to suppress in prior state court litigation, and with the same attorney that was representing him in federal court. So to this day, there's absolutely no basis, one, for any finding that there had been any showing, much less allegation, that the evidence contained in the records was favorable or material, or that somehow the government was on some type of constructive notice or acted with willful blindness.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Romero.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Todd, anything further?
May it please the court, I'd like to address a few issues. First, it's important to point out that this is the first time that the government has mentioned that the restitution calculations are based on Long Beach mortgage records. Previously, there's only been a single sentence in the PSR stating that they are based on public records, which the government again reiterated in their brief. Turning to the meat of the restitution issue, the government ignores that the burden of proof lies on it, that it needs to prove the restitution calculation in order for it to comport with the requirements of the MVRA. They did not do so here. They claim that Long Beach Mortgage, for example, originated the sale-side loans. However, there is no evidence provided at trial that they did so. The evidence that the government did suggest relating to the Kingston property is the only one of the sale-side loans for which there is documentation that was introduced at trial. In particular, in a case like this, even had the defense not provided anything in the way of objecting or evidence supporting their dispute of the PSR, when we look at a similar situation in the case United States versus Swanson, we see that that's not enough to relieve the government of their burden of proof. I'd also like to
point about the points Mr. Romero made about the Silverthorne issue. And about the motion for return of property.
With what the government said on Brady and the motion to return the property, I believe they are mischaracterizing the behavior of counsel below. In particular, at both the July and the October hearings, and the July hearing at page 5 and the October hearing at page 12, the defense counsel tries to mention that he wants stuff for potentially exculpatory purposes. In particular, in the July hearing, it is an incomplete paragraph because he is cut off by the district court. What was the second thing you'd asked?
Wait, I don't understand. Are you saying that that your client never argued that he wanted this material because actually it would show that the state had violated the Fourth Amendment?
He was interested in it for both reasons, as I believe he makes clear, particularly in the October hearing, where he addresses a lot of that specifically.
So he thought there was both inculpatory and exculpatory evidence, inculpatory to prove a Silverthorne violation and exculpatory to defend against the fraud?
Yes, and that's not unreasonable, particularly since the exculpatory information could have gone to his liability at sentencing, not just his conviction at trial.
And is it correct that the district court suggested file a motion for the return of the property in state court if the police were resistant?
The district court did indeed suggest that. However, I would point out the onerousness of going back and reopening a closed state case in order to get a subpoena to retrieve materials to be used in a federal prosecution.
You only have to do that if the police refused a request, which was never made.
True. He never went to the police to ask, and then he would not have needed the subpoena otherwise. For these reasons, we ask that the court reverse it or remand.
Before you leave,
yes.
In your brief, one of the issues you raised was that the district court erred in refusing to your proposed buyer-seller instruction. Are you still maintaining that as an issue before this court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you cite any case where a buyer-seller instruction was given in a mortgage fraud prosecution?
Mortgage fraud, no, but I can in wire fraud and mail fraud. United States versus Gee, there plainly dealt with buyer-seller being imposed not only outside the realm of narcotics, but this court...
Was that a conspiracy case?
That was a conspiracy case, yes.
This is not a conspiracy case, though.
No, however, because it is a scheme case, the government uses many conspiracy doctrines, including conspiracy-related jury instructions, in order to convict. And in Gee, this court said the district court should have sua sponte added a buyer-seller instruction even outside the realm of narcotics when it had never been discussed below at trial.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Todd. And you and the other members of the Bloom Legal Clinic, of course, are pro bono, so we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of your client. Thank Ms. Romero also.